tonight on Arena with me, Evelyn O'Rourke. Lisa O'Neill joins me in studio. Catriona Ní Mhoirichiú and Sharon Ward on their moving and immersive spoken word performance, and we review the band's Robbie Robertson's recent posthumous memoir. You can text us this evening on 51551. Our WhatsApp is at 087-032-3232. Email us at arena@rt.ie, and we're on Instagram at @RTE_arena. But far more exciting than all that is my first guest, Lisa O'Neill, one of Ireland's, I think, most fearless and distinctive voices. The award-winning Cavan songwriter's long-awaited new EP was released today on Rough Trade Records. It includes the extraordinary song, The Wind Doesn't Blow This Far Right, a song she began in 2017, has been working on until this year, and Homeless in the Thousands, which features Pete Doherty. Known for turning her gaze towards forgotten rebels, broken systems and the ghosts that still walk Dublin streets, Lisa O'Neill has spent the past year touring extensively with her own material, Busy Lady, and then with the Pogues too across the UK and North America. And she'll round up the year with a December gig at Dublin's Vicar Street. Lisa O'Neill, I can't believe you found time to come into us this evening in studio. You've been very busy. Big day for you with the release. How do you feel about it today?
Oh, hi Evelyn. Great to be here. And this is a lovely way to mark it. Yeah, I feel delighted. I mean, it's always a lovely feeling when it comes around to the release. You're gathering, working on the songs for a long time. So this is the day we wait for, you know. And I'm looking forward to hearing the response from the public down the line, you know.
Now, as I'm detailing there, right, you've been busy kind of professionally out and about, but you also had a kind of a nice moment recently. You're in Dublin Castle on the big day when President Catherine Connolly got her presidential seal and started off. You've been supporting that whole chapter, I think, a little bit. What was it like in Dublin Castle that evening?
Oh, it was very exciting. I mean, I'd never been to a presidential inauguration before, so this was the first one, and I was so behind Catherine, so it was just a great sense of achievement for everyone. It was amazing to be there and amazing to be in the castle. And well, I met her, all the musicians met her, and she does have that beautiful, special energy about her. It was magic.
And you got to play.
I got to sing a song. I sang the Galway Shawl, and I got all dolled up. And yeah, you're kind of nipping yourself. Look at where we are.
I know. Look at me now.
Yeah.
Here I am. Well, it sounded like that was a pretty kind of special evening, all right. So we've done that. We've talked about the fact that today is such a big day. So let's get into the work then, because that's really what you've been spending so much time and energy on. Can I ask you about the single, The Wind Doesn't Blow This Far Right? It took time to complete. I'm thinking because it's a song that matters maybe so much to you that you really wanted to work on it and get it right. But maybe it took so much time because you're focusing on a lot of topics that were so important to you, I think. Talk to us about the song, the inspiration behind that.
Well, I think I thought I was finished, or that song was finished and wrapped up, and maybe no need for it. I put it away maybe 21 or something, I can't remember. And I felt need to take it out again and rewrite it. Or maybe I started writing a new song and the two of them married each other. But unfortunately, some issues don't go away. They get worse. And of course, yes, it is important to me. At the end of the song, I rally into this drill baby drill. I know a lot of people know whose mouth that drill baby drill comes from. I see parallels with that. And I'm like so many, concerned about our beautiful planet, climate change, and drilling into the Amazon and into anywhere that they can get oil. And of course, the terrorism that's happening out in Gaza.
I think there's a quote where you say, my song is a reaction to the unsettled times that we live in. So is that why the song kept moving away from you and running away from you in a way? Because you felt it kept changing, that the deal with the world you knew kept changing.
It's getting harder and harder to write and anyone as an artist to express how they feel about things, you know, to choose our words and to write about something that you care so deeply about, and you know a lot of others do as well, without being destroyed and cancelled, without ruining your career or taking your own platform away. It's become quite an obstacle course.
So you're second guessing your words?
No, I'm not second guessing my words.
There's a different tension there?
I got to edit.
Okay.
And choose.
And is that new, if you know what I mean? When you look back over your career, you're more aware of that now.
I feel that's more intense in the last 5 years, yeah.
Are you acutely aware of it to the point where it's changing your creative process, or do you write and then edit, if you know what I mean?
Both. I've always written and edited, but it certainly is a challenge how we choose our, you know, well, it's important to choose your words as any form of writer,
yeah.
Anyway. But as you can see, I'm sort of being vague about the subject. What am I getting at in this song? Fear. There's a lot of fear in the world. People are afraid of a lot of the unnecessary. People in power are rallying on,
mm-hmm.
And on so many levels, you've got all these amazing innocent people not knowing what's going on around them, you know.
And that's though the role of the artist, isn't it, to be that person standing back, observing, and then trying to capture it in some way, and trying to give audiences and give listeners and give their fans some sort of way of articulating or seeing through that?
I guess so. You know, there's a sense of, I don't want to focus in on one particular area, but there's a sense of helplessness. For example, with what's going on out in Palestine, we take to the streets, we use our voice as much as we can,
mm-hmm.
But we can't get near those people to let them know that, you know, you're in our hearts. We see that's wrong. It's wrong what's going on. Again, when it comes to politics, it's difficult. So we try and write about it in form of metaphor. And I'm trying to talk in metaphor now.
I understand. Why don't we let the music do the talking for us? The two of us stumbling around this.
Yes,
let's have a listen to it. I think you're happier with that. This is that track that I'm just talking about. This is The Wind Doesn't Blow This Far Right. So let's take a listen to this and have a chat after.
I've lately been thinking of an old friend who I haven't seen in a while. Last night I dreamed that the same friend passed without saying goodbye. Oh, to be wild like the roses. Oh, to be red with delight. My blood is red out of fury. The wind doesn't blow this far right. Sometimes some leaders are players, and players sometimes can be clowns, and clowns then sometimes can be dangerous when they're there and yet they can't be found. The Big Mac, the big man, the big the power of money lies. The power of fear in the peace.
There's so much going on in that song. It seems deceptively simple, and then you're weaving in voices and obviously all the instrumentation of it as well. Technically then, are you pushing yourself a little bit? Is it different from other work you've done?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an extension of other work. Yeah, of course it's different, and it has to be. I'd want it to be. And I'm working with some new people as well. There are people in here I'm working with that I've never worked with before, like Iona Zajac is singing backing vocals, Jordan O'Leary, an amazing musician based in Dublin as well, Cork musician, Seamus Hyland on accordion. These are people I've been knocking around with in Dublin over the years, and they kindly said, yeah. And then, of course, my own band.
So real collaboration stuff there. But I'm watching you listening and I'm just wondering what it's like for you to listen to the album today, knowing it's out now, that all the hard work, you know, you now have released it.
Oh, it feels good. I'm used to that big gap between the release. But we did listen to it on the vinyl test pressing the other day, and it had that extra new sheen on it. Maybe sheen is the wrong word, but that was very exciting. It sounded that little bit different than it ever had before.
All the different processes. You know, Sheen is good. You've had such success. You know, your fans are so loyal to you. I mean, I know there's radios all over the country and they've gone right up in volume when they hear that you're going to be on the air. But I'm just thinking of things like, you know, your version of Bob Dylan's All the Tired Horses. That was used to close out that last episode of Peaky Blinders. How does it feel to know that you've that kind of cultural significance, that your voice is such a good soundtrack for so many people?
I don't really think about it that way, but it does blow my mind that my music is associated even or connected in there. I was a huge fan of Peaky Blinders. I was watching it all the way. And just that little brush with Bob Dylan as well, because it's his, that's his song.
Sure.
That was a fantastic experience for me to look deeper into somebody else's songwriting. That song is very, very simple, but it's not. And I enjoyed the challenge, and I think it influenced my own writing.
Yes. Can I talk to you about the Pogues? Because I mentioned earlier, obviously you've been touring with your own work, but that idea of exploring Shane McGowan's work and the Pogues and that sound, why that for you? What draws you to that music?
I grew up with the Pogues. My brother was a massive fan. So it feels very nostalgic. And I just feel lucky to have been invited in by them. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't do a job interview to go in and sing with the Pogues in the absence of Shane. So Shane's music, the Pogues themselves, like it's there, you know, it's both. And it's been incredible, like dream come true, time of my life.
Why?
Well, the music's fantastic. To be able to play with a band that good, that size, they have a full brass section. And then the audience as well. The audience are incredible. Like, you know, they're just so excited to be back there for a couple of hours. And when you're standing on the side of the stage, because there's several of us singers, when you're standing on the side of the stage at this gig for a couple of hours, I'm not on for, I have a good hour to wait. Dying to get on.
Yeah.
Like, like
really, joining a party
like a really,
or something.
Really hot day standing on the beach and all you want to do is get into the water. That's how it feels. And just they've looked after us so well. So the tour was incredible, you know. I saw some wonderful places.
So it didn't feel like a pressure in terms of not being Shane, but having that role. It was more a gang of you celebrating him. Is that fair to say?
Celebrating him and also grooving with the Pogues, and they're fantastic musicians. I wish Shane was still here as well. Unfortunately, he's not. But they still have so much life in them, and to be working with them, they really are. Brilliant energy too. It's a dream come true, and it's extremely inspiring as well. So, like, you've got to live up to those lyrics. And I don't think you can half sing these songs. You've got to do them fully or
full
step
commitment.
Back. You're not going to make it. Like, you'll disappear, you know.
I want to talk to you about you as the writer and you using real world and how it informs your songwriting. For example, Homeless in the Thousands, the song that features Pete Doherty, it paints that very kind of stark picture of modern Dublin. How do you work on converting a kind of a thing you see or a lived moment into your creativity? How does that work for you? Are you writing it down in notebooks? Are you just letting images swirl around? Is there a responsibility there? Like, what's driving you?
Emotion, usually, you know, an impact, especially something like that that is serious and sad. In fact, the last time I was in an arena with Sean Rocks, bless him. I was in to talk about this song.
Sure, he always loved having you in studio. You had great chats with Sean Ross over the years. Yeah,
he was fantastic.
Absolutely.
I live in Dublin city centre, and I've been here for 25 years, and it has impacted me. And anyone who's got any empathy in them cannot turn the blind eye to the reality of what it is like for homeless people here in Dublin. So I go home feeling quite sad about it, and that becomes something. I have to deal with that emotion, and I've been like that my whole life. I have to, whether it's a positive one, whether I've, you know, had an amazing night, or my heart is falling in love, or I'm very saddened by someone else's experience, then I'll try, for want of a better word, to harvest that, not only to have the song down, but to get it out of my system. And that's been the way for me. It's healing, and then sometimes, not all the time, you have something to put out there into the world. And I don't think, I can't see how my song can help people on the street right now, but it is a sense of awareness around the subject. And it's got worse since I've written the song. The numbers have gone up.
There's so much in that album. I think people are going to, or the EP, people are really going to enjoy it. It's one of those, listen again and again and again. And I'm sorry to say we're only getting a chance to play one more. I'm going to say goodbye to you, because I'm sure there's other places you need to be on a big day like today. But we're going to let you leave to the sound of your own voice with the song In the Bleak Midwinter. This is a traditional Christmas song, and yet in your hands it feels just that little bit different. Of course, yeah, Lisa's putting her finger very politely as if we're in school. You're allowed to speak, go on.
We're going to be in Spin Dizzy Records next Monday at 5 o'clock and in store with the to perform the 6 pieces.
Excellent. Lisa, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Best of luck with your EP. I can see how much it means to you.
Thank you.
Listen, let's take a listen to In the Bleak Midwinter. Gormila Magath.
In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Angels and archangels
Agus for Gaid Míle Fáil sa Ascaidí Arena. Here we are on this cold and frosty Wednesday night, so get closer to the radio. This is where all the nice things are happening. And this Sunday, an dánach bé ócáid speciál ag Thorlú ag Imran. This Sunday, the annual Irish Language Literary Festival will be taking place in Máille Ó Cloí in Dublin, and it's running in at the moment, but this Sunday in particular, Cuitrín Ní Mhorthú, Neil Toner Jr. and singer Sharon Ward will be presenting we're laughing about this. I'm going to just take a leap here. In my Gaeilge, I would say Éireann Gaeilge.
Perfect.
Cuitrín Ní Mhorthú has monster Gaeilge, would say.
Éireann Gaeilge.
Yeah, I'm winning.
Yes.
I'll go back to my intro. A show inspired by an anthology of the same name, and it explores themes of home and absence through text, music and video, or as Cuitrín Ní Mhorthú puts it laughingly there, a long song cycle. I'm joined in studio now by Cuitrín. You're going to tell me a little bit about Imran. Let's start with that. Thus Muid Le Sin. So this is a festival that's really close to your heart. Why?
Why? I think it's a really special festival. I think it's a really important festival. And it's a festival that hopes to bring Irish language literature to, you know, to the public, I suppose. And it shines a light on it, and it shines a light on the depth and the breadth of it, the width of it, the art of it, what you can do with it, you know, because there's everything from lectures to hip hop to, you know, like it's so wide ranging. And I think it's a really exciting festival, actually.
The elephant in the room, I think, for some people of Gaeilge, they think it's a little bit dreary and a bit old-fashioned, and it's filled with texts that are kind of impenetrable. The point, I think, of what you're doing and the point of Imran is to absolutely just kick it into shape and have fun with it and pull from every influence to bring it to life, to bring that energy to it.
Yeah, to kind of, you know, and I think, look, in any language, there are texts that are dreary that you have to kick around a bit, you know, whether it's Aeschylus, you know,
exactly.
You know, whether it's Aeschylus or whether it's, let's say her name,
no,
Peg.
No,
yes!
I am her biggest defender.
I am too.
Don't get me started. You and I have discussed Peg before.
Oh my God, the much maligned Peg.
Wait, that's anyway, a sidebar.
That's
moving
a
sidebar. On.
That's the documentary.
That one working woman story we have, and we have to bat her for. Go
absolutely.
On, yeah.
But I do.
Go Peg.
Go Peg.
Go on, back on track.
But any text that you look at that has complexity, that speaks to possibly, not everybody needs to be taken apart and the nuts and bolts of it looked at and pushed into other forms in a way. And I think this festival absolutely does that. And there are so many artists rooting around in the weeds of Irish language literature. And the things that come out are fantastic.
Oh, you know? It's beautiful language. You see, they win on the language.
They win on the language.
They've won.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your work, though, the work you're doing with Sharon Ward.
Sharon Ward
and with Neil Toner. Yeah. So talk to us about that piece.
So it started with, I suppose, and this is like, it started in a way with Neil Toner Jr. Mm-hmm. Because it started with, he has a band called The Prongs. And John Fleming is a writer, and they came together and they created this kind of literary punk band, which looks at the 80s immigration experience. And the response of the audience to that music was really interesting to me. And that coincided with a rise, if you like, in anti-immigration feeling. And I thought, this is really interesting that those two things are happening in my life at the same time. Imran was looking for ideas. Mm-hmm. And I remembered this compendium, because this piece is absolutely based on the phenomenal work of two other women. And they put together this, I suppose they call it, the full title is Éireann Gaeilge Díolam Litríochta Ar Scéal na Himirce. So it is a literary compendium of the story of emigration. And so Maureen, Nick Owen and Aisling Ní Chonacha compiled this. So they've done the hard work, actually. And what I've done is I've vampired their work, really. I've kind of gone in and gone, I like this, I like
the
this.
The magic
and
does
I like
bit.
This. The magic. And thankfully, Lachlan O'Toorish and Chloe Chonachta said, all right, you can use it.
So you've 10 sequences.
I have 10 sequences.
So if I go to see this, what will I see and what will I hear?
What you will see and what you will hear is both a visual, polyphonic response to our current engagement with immigration and emigration. So we started, it's quite a complex piece. So Neil is composing and doing live track, both analog and electronic.
While I'm sitting there. While, wow.
Yeah.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, ambient keyboards, things sure, that I don't understand.
Uh-huh. You're doing very well, though. It's like very impressive.
I'm very impressive. And I have literally, I'm doing the thing that I have always wanted to do, which is I am playing a theremin live on stage. I cannot. I am beside myself with excitement.
Another bucket list moment.
Another bucket list moment. And we spent around 6 months collating video as well in response to the pieces that we've chosen. And the pieces that we chose, they were very difficult. The first draft was around 100 pages. And so the big work was whittling it down to something that was within 60 to 70 minutes long.
I'm going to stop you there because I think that's the art of the artist. Everybody can start off the phone book. It's the curation. It's the choices, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
That, to me, is when the artist's voice and soul comes alive, really, because it's the audience doesn't know the bit that's not there. So you've had to make choices to make something sing.
Yeah, somebody, you know, it's what you leave outside the frame. Mm-hmm. It's always what you leave outside the frame is the art.
So what guided you then in terms of those choices?
I think what guided me were stories that I hadn't known very well. Because I suppose actually to go back to the beginning in a way, like I had a general idea of emigration in a way. We know the famine, we know the 50, but we don't know the detail of that in a way, or at least I didn't, to be specific. And so I was looking for detail that resonated with me in terms of my own lack of knowledge.
Okay, give me examples that kind of excited you when you're turning the pages faster.
Examples like men in the 50s in Dagenham sharing beds, time sharing beds.
So one guy do a shift.
One guy would be burning the coal in the furnaces of the factory. So he's working at night and he would share with the guy who's on, working actually in the factory during the day. Like exactly what was happening and is happening in Dublin to people who are coming here. Time sharing beds, men, mostly men going over, particularly to England. There's a description of 200 men starting on the same day in Dagenham in Ford car factory. 200 men, all from Cork. All of them from Cork. Stories of men selling their farms so they could go over to send this money back to the women and children at home. So it's just literally like it's like a kind of an archaeological shadow to what's happening now. And I just thought, we do absolutely reference what's been happening in terms of rioting and burning and flag raising. We name that. Because I was not going to actually. I thought, oh, it'll speak for itself. And I thought, actually, the context of this, both as a piece of work and why we started to do it, is that. So we start with that and we end with that. And in between, we bring you on a whole polyphonic, visual, musical journey. And there's spoken word. There's text. I'm doing text live. There's also, because of the breadth of the voices, we chose other actors. I went to Donacha Crowley, who has an outrageous voice.
We were talking about him last night. He's in that beautiful new film,
Abode.
His wife on screen was here, Rosa Henderson, this last night.
He's such a great actor.
He's magic in that film. Yeah,
he's a great just actor. Magic. Yeah. And his Irish is divine. And Rohi Moran Triel is a very famous Northern writer, Mickey McGowan. And I really tried, but I thought I'm not doing this piece service. So I broached Nisha McCaffiel, who is a wonderful, wonderful singer and actor. And he's reading those bits. So they're recorded and...
Excellent. The reason I'm looking at you funny is I think we have a clip of that actually, of Nisha now doing their recording, the stories from a little hint or sense of what you're going to be doing during Imran. So we're just going to take a little clip.
Oh,
can you give
great.
Us some idea of what we might expect when we hear his voice?
I think for me it was, in terms of if you're looking at this on the stage, we found a glorious documentary about the workers that he is describing in this clip. So what you will see is real time footage from the time
while he's talking in a record and Neil will be playing lonesome guitar and humming live on stage.
I know this is a radio moment. If I could describe a person as swooning, that is what you're doing right now in your chair.
I do, yeah. I do swoon when Neil plays the guitar.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll all get a sense of the swooning. Let's have a quick listen here to some of that.
Amerika sınaymışın, hargırayla hebrini dalihici, marın ergici xahura taşta da cigulya markyarta el sirin aşki. Fıkıcı var hobuzun, ahe o açgı hâçırın açırıntı, agız idik markyarta vajin nagasın, nasıl spesi dırga xarışçı, narın giyin heyn.
Stop swooning there now.
Oh.
Gaelgans and gogs, gocher the dollar right.
Nach, yeah, she doch creature really, yeah.
Let's talk about Sharon Ward, who I know is somebody you're very excited about collaborating with.
Yes, absolutely.
Sharon brings such a unique kind of style, I suppose, to
she
her
does,
performance.
Yeah.
Now, in her case, she's written a song from the words of Moira Onion, a Garrel's poem, the searing poem, really, Cé Ila Who Would Return. Tell us about that work and what that piece is.
I thought it was a really interesting poem, I suppose, because a lot of the poems that are in the compendium, which is Díolam, let us stick to the Irish language version, look at, I suppose, a nostalgia about home and a looking back and a remembering. And this poem remembers, but then there's a kind of a sharp edge to it, which is, but actually, I don't belong here. I don't even recognise the barnacles on the rock. You know, I can see the heather on the dusk line, but it's no longer mine. You know, I don't belong here. You know, I don't belong here anymore, nor do I belong to the crowds that I'm going back to. But it's where I am and it's kind of where I have to be now. So why would I return to remind myself that I no longer belong to where I wish to be? Like, it's heartbreaking. And I thought that Sharon's voice and her music and how she creates was a perfect match for that, really.
So it sounds like with this piece, you've been able to collaborate with people who've gone with you on what you're trying to do, which is really delving into the heart of that emigrant's dilemma, you know?
Yes.
They go for one reason, but the price is so high.
But
that's
the
paid.
Price is so high. Like, there's an astonishing description of a man who's leaving Galway to go to Birmingham. He arrives there. It's dark. It's raining. The mists. And he goes up a side street into the house where he's going. And there's a man from the Aran Islands there, Colleen. And Colleen is sitting by an unlit fire in his Aran jumper and his little, it's just, and he gives him his sandwiches that he, like, it literally makes me cry every time. You just think, oh my God. And he goes, I'll try and get you a job on the site tomorrow. We're digging the pavement. I'll see what I can do. But it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking stuff. Yeah.
Also, I think for someone like you, knowing the young men who went over, you say, amazing.
Yeah.
But a lot of women obviously went over.
A lot
we've
of women,
that story
yeah.
too. I always think it's so amazing, Dancing with Lunacy. You know, the two sisters have drifted off and they disappear. And that bit always kind of gets
nurses,
you at the end.
The nurses,
and
of course.
Just,
you
know, and cleaning and all those kind of jobs. But the Gaeilge bit, there were, you know, we know of people who went over who literally had no Berla, like, who
walked
the streets of burning mass Gaeilge. Like.
And Colleen is that. And I think what's really interesting in terms of that story is that it's the Irish girls behind the bar who are like, oh my God, he's mortifying us. And they give him a terrible time. They won't serve him a pint because they're like, oh, for God's sake, will you just learn enough English? Like, you know, it's really interesting, those splits that happen. There's kind of descriptions and you couldn't put it all in. Like, I wish I had, like, you know, the trilogy.
The 24-hour
production. The 24-hour production. Next year.
Next year. I'm going to get you to say it one more time for me.
Okay.
Because I think you say it nicer than I do.
Oh, I don't.
What is the name of your show again, Catrín Le Huarco Más the Hulé?
Oh, Eric Gugrich, Dílam Litriachta Erskéil na Himrike.
Okay, so what we're going to do is I'm going to give you a signal and we're going to do a co-outro here. Okay, 3, 2, 1, you say Eric Gugrich.
Eric Gugrich.
Is in the Dot Theatre in Dublin at 2 p.m. on 23rd of November this Sunday, and further details are available, of course, at imran.ie. When Robbie Robertson died in 2023, he left behind his memoir, his second book about his life. But this time it's all about his friendship with Martin Scorsese. Robbie Robertson was the guitarist and songwriter in The Band, also known as Bob Dylan's backing group from 1965, played in Woodstock, and their final concert in 1976 was famously filmed by Scorsese in the movie The Last Waltz. Journalist Pat Carty has been reading the second memoir called Insomnia. He's here to tell us about this crazy part of the late musician's life. Pat, you're very welcome to the studio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You might remind us first, Robbie Robertson, you know, we know that the band is originally the Hawks, but talk to us about him. You know, why is he this character, this larger-than-life character that's lived on?
Right. Well, I mean, the band... It's hard to kind of judge how famous the band were. As you mentioned, they were Bob Dylan's backing band, and this is when Bob Dylan went electric in the mid '60s. And
some of us aren't still over that.
Yeah, yeah,
some of us
yeah.
Are
I
still
understand that.
Newport crying.
I understand that.
You know, and some of us are still in therapy about it.
Judas at him and things like that. But they were the backing band behind him, where he'd turn around and say, "Play louder," and they went up to Woodstock, as you mentioned, when Bob Dylan had his famous or infamous motorcycle crash, or maybe he didn't, but that's what he claimed happened anyway, so he could get off the road. They went up there and they were recording, just messing around for days to day, and that came out later on as The Basement Tapes, which is a famous Dylan album that came out in the middle of the 70s. But the band kind of, the Hawks as they were known, kind of formed their own sound and changed their name to The Band and recorded two unbelievably great records straight out of the bat. In 1968, I think it is, there's an album called Music from Big Pink, because the name of the house where they were staying was Big Pink. And then a year later, they released an album that's known as the Brown Album because of its cover, but it was just called The Band. And that's really what they're famous for. And the reason Robertson stands out, if he does stand out, is that he was the main songwriter. Now, he wasn't one of the singers. There was three great singers in the band, and he sang the odd time, but he wrote all those songs. So stuff like The Night Did, famous songs like The Night Did, Drove Old Dixie Down and things like that all come from him.
If only we had if The only. Night They Drove Dixie Down ready to play. If
the Miracle of Radio.
What can I hear? Am I hearing something? Oh, that's the band live in the studio. Like everybody else, we're both singing along to that part in the studio, but luckily the microphones weren't. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's good. Yeah. You know, it's good. Yeah. So listen, the first memoir, right?
Yeah.
Goodbye to the first memoir. Let's focus on this second memoir, the Insomnia one. Obviously, it's about him and Scorsese. Yeah. First off, how do they meet?
Well, they're working on the band. Sorry, keep going after that second album. They release another couple of albums. And eventually, around the mid-70s, they have a huge big concert to celebrate that they're kind of taking a break, I think it was how they described it at the time. And this becomes a movie and an album called The Last Waltz. And Scorsese is brought in to direct this. He does it while he's making New York, New York at the same time, which is this huge big musical with Liza Minnelli and Robert De Niro. And he kind of does this at the weekend. He kind of does this on the sly. It's mentioned a few times that he doesn't get paid for it at all, but he's the director of this movie. And so they become very close while they're working on this. And Robertson is not only a musician in it, he's one of the producers of the film. And what happens is then that you know, he's been living this dissolute kind of lifestyle, and his missus, Dominique is her name, they're living in a house in Malibu. And eventually she says to him, listen, time for you to move out. You know, you're concentrating on your work and you're concentrating on your extracurricular activities more than your family. And so he's looking for a place.
Now, Pat, I'm going to stop you there, because the line is, the lifestyle was where drugs and alcohol have become as common as peanut butter and jam.
That's the line, exactly. Yeah.
Let's get straight in.
I mean,
there.
Let's remember when this is now. This is the mid-70s. So
I mean, we have to get on to the drug-fueled stuff. Well, I mean, it's absolutely bonkers, the whole thing. What a crazily, brilliantly...
Well,
wild time.
I mean, we should point out, of course, we're not advocating that drugs are fun or anything like that. Absolutely not. But it does seem to be fun for these guys for a while, anyway, you know. And there is some crazy stories. He moves in with Scorsese, just to quickly bring it up. And then, there's all sorts of stuff. There's a guy, Steve, who's Martin Scorsese's assistant, who is crazy altogether. Absolutely. Brings him up, Robertson, up to his room at one stage and pulls back this hidden kind of wardrobe, slide wardrobe, to reveal this arsenal of guns in there, all sorts of stuff, bullet belts and all that, just in case anyone comes up to the house, because they're all very paranoid. There's another instance where Francis Ford Coppola, the director of The Godfather, comes over to the house and he sees that the two lads are very skinny, and he says, listen, I'm going to hire a chef for you, I'm going to get someone to cook for you, and I'm going to make some dinner for you now. And they had to go off to a screening, so they arranged, they got an old movie camera from upstairs, brought it down, put it beside the pot, arranged it in such a way that this was automatically stirring the sauce. And he said to Robertson, who wasn't going, he said, look, give that an hour and then take it off the hob or it'll be ruined. And so Robinson's going, yeah, sure, I'll do that. But about half an hour into it, he gets a phone call from his drug dealer, who's got a brand new delivery of the very good stuff. So he has to hop in the car, go over to him. So by the time he comes back, the sauce is ruined.
What?
And Coppola isn't talking to him. But he does bring the lads off into the other room and lets them sample the ware, so it's not so bad, you know, they're happy enough. But I mean, it's just crazy. There's another time where he's in Japan, as they're touring the movie, and he makes the mistake, he just casually mentions to someone, listen, is there any blow or is there any chance of getting a bump of something here, you know? And in Japan, of course, as we found out in the Paul McCartney book that also came out this week, you don't do that kind of thing. Paul McCartney ended up trying something similar and ended up in prison for 10 days. So he's told to just back down. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And then Scorsese nearly dies in the book, because he's bronchitis since he was a kid, so that's never a good idea to be mixing medicine, so we say, with that kind of thing. And he's brought in and he's put in hospital, and he calls Robertson and he says, come on and get me out of here. So he gets him out, rescues him from this hospital, and then ring a doctor the next day because he's still not feeling well. And it happens that the doctor is also Robertson's doctor. So he says, look, I'll go with you because maybe I'll be able to get some quaaludes or something off this
fella.
That's
the memoir you'd really like to read, the doctor's memoir. Go on.
They go down to this doctor, and the doctor says, listen, you lads have got to stop doing cocaine. And they go, oh, we don't want to hear that. And the doctor says, because it's the 70s, he says, you should do what I do. You should take a bit of speed, you know. And your man goes, well, that's a bit heavy. So, but just break the tablets in half. And take them one at a time, you know. And that's just one of the things that happens. As I say, he nearly dies another time. And the doctor says to him, are you finished making movies? And Scorsese is kind of thinking, what do you mean? So have you done all you want to do? And he says, no. Well, then you've got to stop taking drugs or you're not going to make it.
But when I read what you're talking about there, right, and we're very aware of the Scorsese series that was out so recently,
yes,
the Rebecca
Miller
series.
Which Robertson is in, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how did any of them survive the 70s? Well, sorry, not only that, but produce amazing work.
Yeah.
I mean, when
well,
you look at their work, it's astonishing that they survived and it all happened.
You know? I mean, this is the period we're talking about here, The Last Waltz, and also the writing and producing and of Raging Bull, which is seen as one of Scorsese's great masterpieces. And you wonder how they got anything done at all. You also wonder how they lived. I mean, what's never acknowledged in this type of book is that...
A lot of staff.
Yeah.
Is that
these people live in a very privileged position. You know? These are both wealthy men, famous men.
And people are making money out of them, the studios and the albums.
And people are making allowances for them. So I'd say when, police and things like that might have maybe... You know, I don't want to badmouth the Los Angeles police or anything like that, but maybe they might have looked the other way now and again because of who it was. You know, that's always been the way with celebrity culture. And it certainly was in the 1970s, I think.
But creatively, the stuff was extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the making of Raging Bull is a good half of the book. And Scorsese starts off and this guy saying, listen, we have this idea for a movie about a boxer, Jake LaMotta. And De Niro, who's in this book a lot, Robert De Niro, is kind of pushing for it. And Scorsese isn't sure about it. He's not really a sports kind of guy. But it turns out, to, as I said, to be one of his great masterpieces. Now, I always thought, I saw it, like everyone else did. I mean, you've seen the movie, haven't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I don't know if it's something that you'd watch a lot, go back and watch again. It's because it is kind of, you know, it's beautifully done and everything, but the central character is so unpleasant. There is an incident in this where they're all out to dinner or something, and Jake LaMotta, the boxer, is there, and his wife, and if you've seen the film, you know they had a troubled relationship, and Tony Curtis happens to be there, right?
The name Tony, list that you're naming, yeah, like exactly. It is name dropping, yeah, of a fabulous level.
Tony Curtis.
I turned around and there was Tony Curtis standing beside him.
Beautiful looking man, still yeah, a beautiful yeah. looking man at that time. And of course, Mrs. LaMotta, whose name I can't remember, sighs at one stage because he's so good. Just sigh, you know the way.
Yeah. Right?
And LaMotta goes bananas. He freaks out. You know, he gets really... Well, he's just an unpleasant kind of guy. He's just an angry kind of guy. I mean, the thing about De Niro in it is that he starts, you know, when they're making the film at the start, De Niro is working out all the time and gets into such great shape to be able to do this. But then, and I think the way it was done is that it was done in two halves. So all the boxing stuff was shot and De Niro was in great shape and doing all this. And then they took a break while De Niro went off to get fat. And basically, he goes off to Italy at one stage on an eating tour. Then he comes back and he's out to dinner with Robertson at one stage. And he's going, yeah, oh, this is terrible. It's a horrible thing. I have to eat all this pasta and all this ice cream and everything. And so he's eyeing up the menu while he's talking. Oh, fried chicken and scalloped potatoes. Yeah, I'll have that to start anyway. And, you know, he's talking about how his thighs are rubbing together and he can't really, it just feels really bad.
Well, Robertson's noting all this. That's the writer bit in and whatever. And it's funny, we were talking about him earlier and I just have a meeting brought back to late night, I think, you know, Radio 2 FM, the Jerry Ryan late night, Dave Fanning, Mark Cagney era. And I just remember they played Somewhere Down in Crazy River, it seemed, every night on it. I remember doing my homework, whatever, listening to it. Might take a little taste of it here just to remind us of Robbie Robertson in action. Doing our homework, that's, I think, right, yeah. Listen to that.
I'd say that's 87, is it something? I would have been about 15. I remember buying that when it came out. I remember buying that record.
I think I was in first class.
Well, you'd be a lot younger than me, yeah.
Come here, talk to me about that voice of his.
Yeah, the voice, I mean, it wasn't something he appreciated himself.
But listen to it there. Like, yeah, it fills the speaker.
It's not the same as like the other guys in the band. It's something he grew into. And he had a great solo career, actually. That's off his first solo album called Robbie Robertson. As we said, around 1987, I think U2 were on a couple of the songs on it. And then he made one called Storyville, which is kind of a New Orleans record, and several others. But he worked with Scorsese all through his life. He only died in 2023, I think. But he got a posthumous Oscar nomination for Killers of the Flower Moon. I was listening to that the other night. He did the soundtrack to that.
The soundtrack for Scorsese.
Yeah, he was part Indian himself. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say Indian. Part Native American.
Okay, so he understood that story.
So he did a lot of that. I remember he did a huge documentary series in the 90s about that as well.
Okay, and Pat, you're now down in Crazy River yourself in memory lane. Quickly, am I putting this on a Christmas list?
Oh, I would, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's funny. you know, if you take it in one way. And also for the art.
Like, does he know how crazy it is?
He doesn't. He doesn't really. You know, he's always had a kind of. He you can tell he kind of loves himself, you know. But sure, I mean, fair enough. He was in the band and he was working with Scorsese, you know. Sure, if you can't love yourself after all that, fair enough, you know. And the drugs thing is kind of like, this is unreal, lads, you know. But it's certainly amusing while you're reading it.
So the detail is there, his recall is there, the names are there, the charm is there.
It covers everyone. He's very clever. It covers movie fans, obviously, and then it'll cover music fans as well, because it kind of split between the two. You can see while the band is breaking up, he's moving off into another career. He does a bit of acting himself in a terrible movie called Carney as well, which he acknowledges is
bad. There a third part hidden somewhere?
I wouldn't think so, seeing as he died in 2023.
But he'd written this, right?
But
so do we know is there a mystery third part in a suitcase?
Not that I've heard of. And if he didn't write it already, he's not going to write it now. Put it that way.
Pat, thank you so much for plowing through that for us. Really appreciate it. And that's it from Wednesday Night Serena. And that's it from me. Ciara King will be with you tomorrow evening. I am and was Evan O'Rourke there. Paul Murnoch was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was our BCO this evening. And Sian O'Gorman was the producer. Slán go fóill, go spanacht.